This is John Quinn, and this is Law Disrupted. And today we're talking with one of the most successful, some would say maybe the most successful, patent trial lawyers in the United States over the last 10, 15, maybe more years, Dave Nelson of our firm, who's in our Chicago office. Dave, thanks very much for talking with us today.
Thanks for having me, John.
I think part of the reason Dave is so successful is he causes you to forget that he's actually got an electrical engineering degree from Stanford University and comes across as kind of this Midwestern hayseed type, which in some ways he actually is. He played professional baseball for a while, was a catcher, and has the aches and pains in the knees to show for it, I suspect.
Yeah, at least a few of them. but I mean, I guess part of that is true. I think the aches and pains probably would have been tolerable if I had been a better player. But turns out that I was a better lawyer than a baseball player. So
I was going to say, you've certainly found your métier, and that you've been able to have a run at this trial work. It's certainly longer than the baseball career could have been. But let's focus on, and we want to talk today about how to try patent cases. That's our subject today. But before we get into that, I want to mention what I think is probably a little known fact, and that you've probably, I remember you telling me at one point, you've tried more non-patent sort of commercial cases than you've tried patent cases. That's probably come as a surprise to a lot of people who know you.
Yeah, I mean, I think early on that was true, probably not true anymore, but I started out my first 4 or 5 years just doing insurance defense, contract cases, personal injury, med-mal, those kinds of things, just coming out of law school, and probably did, I don't know, those first 4 years, all we did was try cases. So I did 20-some in those first 4 years. So that takes a while to catch up doing patent cases, although I think I have past that now.
I mean, so even though you had this background in science and electrical engineering, it wasn't in your mind from the start that you would do patent litigation?
No, I didn't even know what patent litigation was. I mean, I went to law school after a conversation with my father because he said he thought that would be an interesting career, that he was an engineer as well. And at the time, I was not real enamored of engineering. It was a little boring. And so he said, yeah, that was a good idea to go to law school from his perspective. But when he was thinking about it, his mother said she wouldn't pay for that because he had to get a respectable job. So after that conversation, I decided, well, I'll go to law school. And the only thing that I knew that lawyers did, there were no lawyers in my family. The only thing I knew that lawyers did was go to court and go to trial. So that's all I ever thought about doing. And the first job that I caught on with, that's what the firm was all about. So they didn't do patent trials or patent litigations. That was later in my career that started to happen.
Well, how did that happen? How did you transition from being a business, a general business or commercial or insurance defense trial lawyer to being the patent litigation specialist that you've been for many years now?
Well, I think a lot of it had to do with that firm that I started out with. I'd look down the hall. You know, I had great experience, a lot of court, a lot of trials, that kind of thing for the first 3-4 years when I was there. But then I looked down the hall at what the partners were doing, and they were doing the same thing I was doing. And I didn't think that that was going to be something that I wanted to be doing 25 years down the road. So I thought about what kind of things can I do to maybe differentiate myself? And I had at least started to hear about patent litigation. You know, this goes back to early 1990s. And it was starting to become more of a mainstream thing for private practice, bigger law firms. Prior to that time, it really was kind of the exercise of boutique firms. So as I started to hear about it more, I thought, well, I got an engineering degree. Maybe I can make a career at this. And when I started doing it, it was interesting to me. It was interesting to keep a foot in the technologies and learn those kinds of things, interact with the engineers at the company, and just kind of happened that way. And It's like anything else in the law. Once you do it, it becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy because that's what people expect you to do.
Yeah, you refer to kind of an interesting phenomenon. We can all remember you date it to the 90s, and I guess that's probably right. I mean, there was a time where patent litigation was really the province of a number of boutique firms. There were firms that specialized in that. And the so-called full service or general commercial firms or firms like ours that do business litigation wouldn't do patent work. That was kind of these specialty firms. But I think as the importance of intellectual property capital and patents grew in everybody's awareness and estimation, the full service firms, more the commercial firms, really saw an opportunity in patent litigation, which was becoming increasingly high value because of all the attention paid to it. And now many of those boutiques simply, maybe most of them, simply don't exist anymore.
Yeah, I think, well, that's definitely true. I think that, you know, patent litigation, if you go back to the 60s, 70s, which I only know about from history books, I'm not quite that old, but it wasn't a big deal. As you say, the cases didn't have real high stakes. It wasn't a focus of the business plan of companies too much. You know, they had these patent prosecutors that they would send out to get them patents. And when there were patent lawsuits, they figured, well, this is about patents. Let's just call the prosecutors. And as things became more high stakes and intellectual property became more of a core asset of companies, they started to look at things differently. Now, initially, what happened is the big firms used to partner with a lot of the boutique firms because it was the boutique firms that had folks with technical experience. And that is a helpful thing with patent litigation, certainly not a necessary. I mean, in order to be a patent litigator, you don't have to be technical. But those kinds of resources are important. And so what the big firms did is started to recruit that kind of talent and bring those people in. And now the big firms could offer both the trial experience as well as the technical experience in these patent cases. And so you're right, a lot of the patent boutiques have kind of been absorbed into other large firms.
Well, you've had the experience trying a lot of business cases, commercial cases, and patent cases. How would you summarize the difference in trying a patent case and trying other types of business disputes?
I mean, in a lot of ways, they're the same, right? It's a trial, and there's things that are common between that. But I think one of the things in the patent case, because a lot of the material is so unapproachable, you know, it requires, in order to have a level of knowledge to really understand what's going on, it requires a lot of foundational knowledge. You know, you have engineers that are trained in this for four to six, maybe more, in college, and then work in that area for many, many years in order to have the foundational knowledge to understand everything. Obviously, when you're talking about a jury or a judge or even most of the lawyers on the team, there isn't going to be that foundational knowledge. So you can't really count on the fact that you're going to be able just to attack the substance of the case and build your record that way and be successful. So it's very, very, very important that you figure out what your story is going to be and figure out what your common sense explanation is for all the arguments you're making. So, for example, you can't just go in and have your experts or, you know, your engineers testify as to, well, we don't do X. You need to be able to translate that into English and say, well, X in the patent is done because, you know, for these reasons, these were the problems they were trying to solve. Well, we looked at these things and decided we need a different solution. And that's why we don't do X and instead we do Y. That kind of story is critical because if without it, it's just noise. You know, nobody will pick up on it. Now, the flip side, though, is you got to make sure that you build your record enough because the Court of Review for patent cases, the Federal Circuit, unlike some other appellate courts, you know, in other circuits, they'll take a very, very close view of what went on at the trial court. You know, some would say that perhaps they do some fact finding. I'm not going to go quite that far, but building your record is important, but you need to do that in balance with having your story. And so that's the most critical thing about patent cases, I think.
Is it fair to say there's an element of teaching? That's a big part of the challenge, I would assume. You're dealing with a technical subject. You have an audience, the jury. You know, you may or may not actually have a technically trained person on the jury. You often do up in San Jose and Silicon Valley, but you may have a jurors of all people who don't have any background, probably a judge who doesn't have any background. So part of what you got to do is help them understand this technology and understand it in a context of a narrative which supports your case. Is that a fair summary?
Again, it's a balance because you need to do some teaching, but you have to do it in a way that people, you know, whether it's the judge or the jury or whomever, don't feel patronized, right? That you're trying to break things down too simply. You know, part of it is, again, it's not a matter of a lack of intelligence. It's a matter of a lack of the foundational knowledge. You know, for example, you can talk about mathematical concepts that might not be that difficult, but without somebody having the foundational knowledge in order to be able to have that discussion, they're not going to get it. You know, it's a little bit like I say, yeah, I don't speak French. So if somebody can talk to me some basic concepts in French, I won't understand it because I don't speak French, right? Doesn't make me stupid. I mean, I might otherwise be stupid, but you still need to have that foundational knowledge in order to be able to communicate. So that kind of balance is always important in a patent case because sometimes if you get too deeply into it, the jury will think you're trying to pull something over on them. Like, why are you spending all this time talking about something that just sounds like gibberish? But the flip side is if you break it down and try to make it too simple, people think that you're basically calling them stupid.
How do you start to think about your narrative? I mean, we needed a different solution. The patent teaches this or describes this, and we aren't doing that. That wouldn't work for us. We have a different idea. So that type of explanation, which you gave us, when you're preparing the case, how at what point do you start thinking about what that narrative or explanation is going to be, and how do you dig that out of the facts that you're given?
Well, quite honestly, where it needs to happen is right at the very beginning. I think and this is counterintuitive to the way that patent cases actually get litigated oftentimes, because what you'll see in patent cases is people try to keep every possible defense open. You know, for example, one of the aspects of patent cases is claim construction. And so defendants oftentimes will try to pick out 15 different terms and say, well, if I win on any of these, then I have a non-infringement defense. Well, that's obviously not effective because you're spreading your resources so thin, and many of those things may be inconsistent with the theme that you ultimately need to tell. Similar with invalidity defenses, people will throw out, you know, dozens of references without really taking the critical look of what's going to be the best argument and how does this fit into the theme. So I think it's very important to sit down early with your client, with the engineers at the client, figure out exactly what that theme's going to be, and then litigate the case accordingly. You know, you need to make these calls early so that you can develop that during discovery and you can pursue the proper arguments. So I think what ends up happening in patent cases is because people, particularly younger lawyers, don't want to be blamed down the road, they try to keep all the balls in the air. And by doing that, you really never figure out what your story is going to be until you get to trial. And then what ends up happening, as you know from trying many cases, it could be too late at that point. So this is something that really you need to make the call on in the beginning. I mean, might it be the wrong call? Well, of course. I mean, that's true of any decision, but that's where things really need to happen.
And judges, I mean, the way patent cases are often tried these days, the judges are not going to let you try a whole multitude of issues. My understanding is that typically, you know, you may get 5 days to try a case. You're only going to be able to put on trial a certain number of claims and terms and defenses. You just don't have time to do an awful lot.
That's exactly right. And the way judges have come about pretty commonly to get patent cases to a point where they're at least digestible by a jury, something that can be tried to a jury, is through time limits. And I think those are more prevalent in patent cases than they are in any other kind of cases. For example, in certain jurisdictions, like in the Eastern District of Texas, very likely you're going to get 11 hours to try your case. That's the whole thing. Cross-examination of the other side, directs of your witnesses, and then you get usually 30 minutes for opening and an extra 40 minutes for closing. Those are separate. But 11 hours is not a lot of time to build your record. So you really need to be focused. And the way you can do that effectively is figure out, since you know that's going to be the case in these jurisdictions, you can go in and say, well, we need, 24 hours of record time to try our case. The judge will smile and say, well, no, you're not going to get it. You get 11, maybe you'll get 12.
Right.
But yeah, you need to do it early on and make your calls early on so that you can have the case prepared in a way where it can be presented in that time frame. Because if you're trying to make those decisions at trial time, it's too hard. And a lot of the record won't be there. There'll be other things. You have these expert reports that people do in patent cases now. I'm sure you've seen some of them that are 1,500 pages long. Well, how can you really effectively have an expert that understands what the case is going to be when you've asked him to cover, every possible base throughout discovery? And what ends up happening is you can see oftentimes when they get there, despite the detailed prep that you do before they get on the stand, it's not there. It's not sunk in. That comes across in the presentation. So to me, that's a critical thing in patent cases that you have to discipline yourself to do. And quite often you can see that it's not done.
Do you think on balance that it's hours, 10 hours, 11 hours, 12 hours, is that enough time, just speaking fairly, in which to get the issues out in front of a jury? Do you think that results in what might be termed fair trials? Or do you feel like these time limits are really handicapping the ability to fully air the issues in an appropriate way?
The answer is it depends. I think that in many cases it can be, particularly if your real defenses are non-infringement defenses, because as a defendant, you can get very focused and that takes much less time. You don't need to cover everything. And as a plaintiff, because your expert goes up first, the jury is a little bit more forgiving in the rote, going through claim by claim than it is by the time you get up to the defense expert. Now, if you really have an invalidity case, then quite frankly, it's not enough time. But if you ask me, I think that's part of what the judges are doing by giving you such limited time, is really limiting the ability to try an invalidity case. Because what ends up happening, you have the patent office, they looked at everything and they examined this and they issued it. And now you're asking a jury to say, well, despite that, it's the jury's province to decide whether this patent actually is valid, right?
At a higher standard, right? If they're going to invalidate it, it's more than a preponderance.
Yeah, it's clear and convincing, which, as the judges make clear, is significantly more than a preponderance of the evidence. Now, exactly what that means, who knows? But it's not beyond a reasonable doubt, that right. We know. But, if you're having an expert put on a non-infringement case, and now you need to put on an invalidity case as well on a couple of patents, you're not going to have more than an hour to do that. So from a jury's perspective, with the experts going through claim by claim, doing that kind of testimony an hour, it's too easy for the other side to say, well, they want to rip this patent up and look, they spent 40 minutes, you know, telling you why that's the case. How can that be clear and convincing? Well, you can only spend so much time because you only have so much time to do the whole case. So those types of cases, if you have an invalidity defense, really put you in a bind.
That might be a situation where you've got a real invalidity defense where you might pitch the judge to give you a little more time.
You could try. And, you know, I'm not saying that will be true across the board. There are certain judges that'll give you a bit more time for that sort of thing, but that varies a lot from, and it's not even jurisdiction to jurisdiction. A lot of times people will say that it's really judge to judge.
Right. I have the impression, correct me if I'm wrong, that expert testimony is generally more important in patent cases. You always seem to have it on both sides. It seems to be, and often, the heart of the case.
Well, I'll say yes and no, and that kind of goes back to the point I was talking about earlier. So certainly the expert testimony is critical and necessary. I mean, with the case law is such that you can't establish infringement if you're the patent holder or non-infringement if you're the defendant without expert testimony. I mean, it's almost impossible because we're always talking about technical subject matter. So that's necessary from a record perspective. But oftentimes what ends up happening as a practical matter is the experts just kind of cancel each other out. You know, the jury's like, yeah, we heard from both of those people and they're experts and they're well-credentialed and that's fine. But where a lot of things end up turning with is with your fact witnesses. You know, if the jury from the defendant's perspective really identifies with some, you know, engineers who really know the product and they're forthright and honest on the stand, that can take you a long way. Whereas experts, it'll oftentimes be more just a canceling out, unless, of course, your expert or their expert does a really, really poor job, then, you know, that obviously can affect things.
Give us some examples of the kind of percipient testimony that you might have, setting aside the inventor and the damages experts. What other types of testimony will you typically see in a patent case from non-expert witnesses?
Well, you'll have the people that actually know the products. I mean, you're going to bring them in, not on the plaintiff side, but on the defendant side. And they're the ones that can really build the story, right? To bring it life. Like, here's, you know, we worked hard on this. These were the problems that we were facing. This is what we were trying to do. And here's how we solved those problems. They're the ones that can really tell that story in a way that the jury can relate to. Because jury's like, yeah, these are the people sitting there in the trenches doing it. It's not just some paid expert telling us what things are, you know, whatever the lawyers want them to say after the fact. These are the people that actually went through things. So in my mind, that's very, very critical testimony, and oftentimes is, I think, not given enough value by clients. It's hard to get access to those people because those people, by definition, at tech companies are in demand. Their time is in demand. And, you know, the last thing most people want to do is have to sit for a deposition and spend a lot of time with lawyers. But it is, I think, the most critical testimony that you can have particularly from the standpoint of a defendant. I mean, it's true as a plaintiff as well, when you have these company to company fights, because it's the same thing. Where did the patents come from? What were we trying to do? How did we solve these problems? So it becomes that kind of testimony. It's a little less that way when you're having a small plaintiff out there that doesn't really make products, because now you're just talking about the inventors, as you described earlier.
I mean, it's interesting the way you describe it. The engineers on the defense side who know the product can talk about the problem they face and how they solved it. That's very similar to, or sort of the flip side of, the inventorship story.
Correct.
The testimony of the inventor on the patent. This is the problem I solved. I had this inspiration. There was a lot of perspiration too. And, you know, the patent office gave me this this patent with a ribbon on it. And as a result of all my good work. But it's the kind of flip side of the same human engineering invention kind of phenomenon.
Yeah, because that's exactly what the jury is more familiar with wrapping their head around, which is, okay, don't just tell me the technical reasons why something's different than the patent. Tell me why you did what you did and, you know, bring it to life. What mm-hmm. what kind of problems were you facing? And, you know, they think that, well, they did this differently and it's a good story. That translates into a non-infringement case. Whereas you could have the best technical defenses in the world and have a great record for that. That's wonderful, but you're trying that case for appeal.
We sometimes hear, especially lawyers from other countries who don't know our system, and I guess lawyers in our country too, they sometimes say, it's inconceivable that these technical cases involving these very complex products and inventions, that you have these cases decided by ordinary Americans, 6, 8, whatever the number is, who get called in just because they're on a voting list or have driver's licenses. And they're going to resolve these highly complicated technical issues. This makes no sense whatsoever. I mean, what would you say in response to that criticism?
The fact of the matter is, if you look at the alternative, I think in many respects, the percentage of times, at least in my experience, where the jury gets it right, is actually greater than where you have, you know, dedicated experts looking at things. And one of the reasons, you know, think about it. If you have somebody who is steeped in the subject matter, you know, an engineer that knows communication theory, and they're going to be the ones that are deciding the ultimate issues in the case, they already know everything. So they don't spend a lot of time listening, right? And they come in with their own prejudices and those types of things that sometimes they won't even pay attention to the actual evidence in the case. Whereas a jury, they don't have the background. They don't have come in with a preconceived notion. So they're listening for the story. They're listening for who's the most credible, who's making sense, the kinds of things that juries look for in every case. Right. And that's what the jury system is all about. That's why we're pretty much the last country that does it. There's a few others that do it now and then, but except for criminal trials, of course. So in that sense, that's why I say it's so important in these cases to really put that story together, because that's the kind of thing that juries can relate to. But somebody that knows the technical subject matter, they probably won't even pay attention to that, because they're just going to be focused in on what they already know. And so you could look at the UK, for example. That's a system that they used for a long time. And what ended up happening is they basically shut themselves down as a jurisdiction where anybody wanted to do patent cases, because the percentage of times where the trier of fact and the judge, I mean, it's like an arbitration. They were making the decision, found a patent obvious, was just astronomical. But of course they did, because, you know, they're bringing their knowledge to it and they're like, oh, this is no big thing. And as a result, their patent system and their patent trials didn't work very well. So, you know, I mean, there's pros and cons to everything. No system is perfect. But in many ways, I think the jury system actually leads to better results. And I say that even though I've lost cases where I thought the jury got it wrong, right? But
did you ever win a case where you thought the jury got it wrong?
Oh, yeah. I mean, at least from my personal perspective, because I will say that my personal perspective, I have the same prejudice as I described with those UK judges. The vast majority of patents that I look at, my own personal perspective is there shouldn't be a patent for this. You know, this is all straightforward, obvious stuff. But, you know, that's different from what the law actually is.
To go back to something that you mentioned early on, do you think it's an advantage or a disadvantage for someone who's aspiring to be a patent trial lawyer to have a technical background. I've heard it argued both ways, that sometimes you can know too much and that'll get in the way of your ability to communicate. But on the other hand, obviously, you've got to have some knowledge in order to share knowledge.
Well, I'll answer it this way. I think that it is an advantage in many respects that can become a serious disadvantage if you don't recognize the shortcomings of it. So you can sit around with a bunch of engineers and you can talk about a particular technology or the reasons why you don't infringe or why a patent's invalid. And you can describe things that in a way where all the people in the room think it's very, very straightforward, it's simple, that sort of thing, but you don't realize you're speaking French and you have an English-speaking audience, right?
Okay.
That's very easy to do. So you have to step back from that and train yourself to step back and say, okay, what are the foundational things that you need to know or at least have some grasp of before you can even get to the level of having the discussion that we're trying to have? So that, I think, becomes important. The other thing is because what I see often, and I have to stop myself from doing, when you have that technical background, you jump to, here's the right answer, without really thinking about how you got there. And when you're trying a case, oftentimes it's the how you got there that becomes the important things that you need to establish. And if you never spent any time thinking about those things, it's kind of hard to establish those when you're trying a case.
I mean, you've been trying patent cases for many, many years now. I assume you enjoy it? You enjoy trying patent cases?
Yeah, I like trials. I mean, patent cases versus any other kind of case, I don't know that I necessarily have a preference. So I'd try any other kind of case. And I think in many respects, I would enjoy it. But at 57 or whatever I am now, having tried patent cases for the last 25 years, and you know, some copyright, source code, copyright, trade secret stuff, nobody's going to pay me to go try a contract case.
They might, especially if they wanted to win. Some people might think of, look, you know, this technical area, trying patent cases, this must be kind of bloodless, must be kind of dull. You're dealing with science. You know, there's no spurned love. Nobody died. There's not going to be human emotion. Some people might think this is a less interesting practice area. What response would you have to that?
Some of it is it just depends on what interests you. For me, you get to spend so much time learning new things that is interesting in and of itself. If you're talking just about the trial of the case, you know, there's a lot of facets that go into a patent case. Because like I say, you know, you have the non-infringement aspect, if you're looking at it from the standpoint of a defendant, and the approach to that is one way. You have invalidity type defenses, and the approach to those is something else. You have damages related defenses, and the approach to that is very different. And oftentimes, the various defenses are going to, in some ways, conflict with each other. And so the strategy of trying to figure out how you're going to present those things and which ones you're going to present that you think give your client the best chance for a good result, that's a little bit like a chess game. And it does develop during the trial as you see how the other side moves their pieces. So I think in a lot of ways, it can be more interesting from a strategic standpoint at trial, at least from my experience having tried other cases. But, you know, we're not going to have people come in and say, well, you know, I slept with the guy's wife and now he's killed my nephew. That doesn't happen in patent cases.
We've been talking with Dave Nelson about trying patent cases. Dave, thank you very much for joining us.
All right. Thanks, John.
Thank you for listening to Law Disrupted with me, John Quinn. If you enjoyed the show, please subscribe and leave a rating and review on your chosen podcast app. To stay up to date with the latest episodes, you can sign up for email alerts at our website, law-disrupted.fm. Or follow me on X at JBQ Law or at Quinn Emanuel. Thank you for tuning in.